KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Preet Bharara joins us. He's the former U.S. Attorney of the Southern District of New York, who was fired from that role by the president shortly after Trump said he wanted Bharara to stay on. Bharara is known for fighting financial fraud, corruption, and violent crime. And for his sharp legal mind, he's been a go-to commentator on the legal questions surrounding the president. We'll hear what Bharara thinks about Attorney General Barr's handling of the Mueller report and how he sees justice and fairness playing out in the Trump era. We get started after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. As former U.S. Attorney of the storied Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara oversaw cases involving terrorism, financial fraud, public corruption, gang violence, narcotics, and arms trafficking, all while supervising an office of more than 200 assistant U.S. attorneys. After Bharara was fired by President Trump in 2017, he joined the NYU School of Law faculty as a distinguished scholar in residence. He's the host of the podcast Stay Tuned with Preet, a regular legal analyst on cable news, and author of a book titled Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. Welcome to Forum, Preet Bharara.
Thanks for having me.
Was being fired by President Trump basically the best thing that's ever happened to you? I mean, your profile exploded after that. I mean, you already had a high profile, but it exploded after that. You've had the opportunity to do so many different things.
Yeah. So, you know, I had the good fortune of being in public service for 17 years. It's a long time. And forewent, you know, being in private practice because I wanted to do the job that I describe in the book at great length. And I would have continued to do it even longer, because I thought there was no better way, given, you know, whatever skills I had and interests I had, to make, you know, the world a little bit of a better place, to make the community a little bit safer. And I would have done that for a longer period of time. So now I have this opportunity to do other things, and it's very gratifying that there are people who are, you know, interested in listening to what I have to say, even here in San Francisco. So, it's been gratifying. It's a different kind of thing to do. And, you know, without... this may sound odd, but I do find this to be another form of service, explaining how the law works, explaining what's going on in the country. In addition to the things you mentioned, I also head up a task force out of the Brennan Center from NYU with Governor Christy Todd Whitman, and we make proposals to Congress and others about how to shore up our democracy. So there's an opportunity to do a lot of things, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
And this book that you've written, Doing Justice, is something that you've wanted to write for some time. It's a manual of sorts almost for prosecutors, in that it really talks about what you say are sort of the four major stages in a prosecution and how to handle those: inquiry, accusation, judgment, and punishment. But it feels like both a manual and also a commentary on our times.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious if that happened for you as this administration played out.
Yeah, a little bit. I just want to make clear that so the original thought I had in my head when I was U.S. attorney in SDNY was to put down my thoughts about how, you know, they could think about truth and the justice process and fairness. But I want to make clear to everybody that it's not a book just for prosecutors. It's not a book just for lawyers. It's really for everybody. And there's no legal jargon in it. And I sort of take the perspective of someone who's had a particular kind of experience, that of being a prosecutor overseeing a lot of cases. But the stories that I tell and sort of the lessons that come from those stories are just as relevant, I think, to people who are in journalism or are managers in offices or are employees at schools, because everyone has to make judgments about other people. Everyone has to make judgments about what the truth is. You know, even if you're just a parent, you may have to make judgments about punishment for your children or settle disputes among relatives. And so all of those lessons that I think I've learned along the way from doing criminal prosecution obviously are relevant to that, but also relevant to everything else. And then with respect to, you know, how it's sort of – some reviewer said something like, this book is a metaphorical survivor's guide to the Trump era. I didn't sort of intend it as such, but it's not a terrible description, because although I don't talk about Donald Trump at any length and by name, obviously – his shadow looms over everything, including the justice system, including this book, because we have too many people who are saying things like, there are alternative facts, or truth isn't truth. And sometimes it's useful to take a step back and remind people of how justice is supposed to be done and how it should be done, and see what the gap is between where we used to be and where we should be versus where we are now.
So there is a system that exists to try and get at the proof, and that is a system that can be replicated and emulated, essentially. It's also, your book is coming out at a time when there is very much interest, intense interest in the way our legal system operates.
Yes.
And also in the way that the special counsel has operated in investigating the president's campaign for possible cooperation and coordination with Russia. And of course, it came to the conclusion that that members of the Trump campaign did not engage in that. But I want to just ask you what your immediate reaction was when you read the Barr letter on Sunday that cleared the president of conspiracy or coordination with Russia and punted on the obstruction of justice charge. And I want your immediate reaction.
Yeah, so my immediate reaction was, this is a pretty short letter that is only 4 pages long. I wanted to know desperately how long the underlying Mueller report is, and I imagine it's hundreds of pages, but maybe it's 50 pages, but I would like to know. I think that would tell us something.
What would it tell us?
I think it would tell us about the view that Mueller had about how thorough he needed to be, one, and two, how thoroughly he needed to document the thoroughness of his investigation. I can use that word multiple times. Because I think there's some question as to whether or not, Mueller was going to be sparse in his documentation of the investigation and the decisions he made to prosecute or not prosecute. And if he decided to be very thorough and very lengthy and document all the decisions with great specificity, then I think you're looking at a much bigger fight down the road as to what becomes public or doesn't become public. And to the extent he's very lengthy in his analysis and his descriptions and in the facts that he was able to gather and collect, we'll get a better picture as to what happened. Even if it's the case on collusion, for example, that he ultimately decided that a crime was not committed, it would still be useful for the public and Congress in particular to have as full an understanding as possible. And then the next thing I thought about this letter that I think a lot of people did was some surprise that Bob Mueller decided not to make a determination about whether or not a crime was committed in connection with obstruction. I think everyone assumed that the reason you have a special counsel is for that person to make the determination and, at arm's length from the president. And he did punt on that. And the awkward analogy I've used, and you referenced it, was that Mueller sort of punted. It looked like he was punting to Congress, but then Bill Barr sort of came in from off the field, grabbed the football, and ran it in for a touchdown for Trump. And people have pointed out, well, that's not how a punt works. And I said, yeah, that makes it a better analogy. Actually, it's not how it's supposed to work.
Well, what is your reaction to the fact that Robert Mueller did not make the call? Do you think that he made the right decision in not doing that?
I don't think anybody can know until we see the full report, especially the part about obstruction. I have always said, and I worked with Bob Mueller in a couple of different capacities, I think he's a really fine person. I think he has a lot of integrity. I think he works hard. He has been completely silent and spoken only through his indictments and court documents over the last 2 years, unlike many other people. So I trust him, and I trust him to make good judgments. But I think it seems what he was thinking was, it's such a close question. The stakes are so high. It's such a big deal. And given the closeness of the question, which is recited in the Barr letter, and again, we need to make sure that we don't overly accept the Barr interpretation, that he thought this is too weighty a matter for me to decide, and that given the system that we have, maybe it's not for the special counsel to say, given what the reaction would be, and we do have a system that doesn't apply to you and me, but applies to a president, of constitutional checks and balances, and it is provided for in the Constitution. And even if it's not the case that you can bring a criminal charge or you decide it's too close to a question to decide, Congress can decide to hold the president accountable in the way that it is allowed to do so, through impeachment or otherwise. And maybe that's what he thought would be better for the country and better for public faith in his work.
And can I read something from your book that struck me, especially in context
of
the fact that Robert Mueller did not make the call. So you write in a section where you're talking about when prosecutors have to make the accusation. You write, the decision to make a public accusation, particularly in the prosecution context, is momentous. And there are people of a certain constitution who sometimes in the name of thoroughness delay that moment unduly. If you're in the business of investigative reporting or internal compliance at a company or, of course, law enforcement, you have to have the fortitude to make the call.
Yes, that's almost always so.
Almost always so. So why is this an exception?
Well, so put Mueller aside for a moment, and I will tell you there have been cases in my office where, and what that passage, I think I, what I was trying to convey was, in the ordinary case where there's a clear answer, there are still people who delay and they're a little bit afraid of making the decision because it becomes all-out war of a sort once you've brought the accusation. But there are cases that are incredibly close, and I was going back and searching my mind for the couple of occasions where, much to my annoyance, but good-natured annoyance, prosecutors in my office were about to make a decision, and they investigated a case very thoroughly, and I take the memo home, which was going to be their recommendation on whether to go forward or not. And in one case I can remember, it was 40 pages long, and there was a lot of analysis. It was very well done, very smart, laying out the evidence in favor of a charge, then laying out what the possible defenses would be and how viable those defenses would be. And I'm waiting with bated breath, and I'm trying to get to the end, but I'm waiting and not turning to the end because I don't want to, prejudge. And I get to the end expecting there to be a conclusion. It's, therefore, for the foregoing reasons, we recommend bringing a charge, or for the foregoing reasons, we recommend not bringing a charge. And there was no conclusion. It sort of ended. And I remember bringing the team in and saying, what's going on, guys? And they said, well, it's really, really close. We wanted to lay out the facts and the evidence. It's sort of the best analog that I can think of in my smaller world to what it looks like the Mueller report did on obstruction. And the discussion we had was, and these people didn't lack fortitude, and they weren't afraid of charging. They just thought, it's a really close question. There are all these arguments in favor and these arguments against. And usually that doesn't happen. Usually it's much more clear. And in that circumstance, when you're bringing the criminal law to bear and the consequence of your decision to go forward will mean the separation of someone from their liberty, we essentially thought that you give the benefit of the doubt to the defendant, and we did not proceed. And that was it. And I'm not saying the name of the party that we were looking at because we never brought the case, and it wouldn't be right to do so. The difference in the Mueller case, as far as I can conjecture, is that it's not the end of the case, because there's a constitutional dimension as well. I think if Bob Mueller were analyzing this and it was an ordinary citizen, a private citizen like you and me, and he made the determination that it was too close a question, I think he would have said that and then we would be done with it. And you wouldn't proceed with a criminal prosecution. The president is different for all sorts of reasons.
Well, it seems that this question has already been addressed somewhat, but I want to get your take on it, which is essentially that Barr suggests in his letter that if you don't find someone guilty of committing a crime, you really shouldn't find them guilty of obstructing or an attempt to obstruct the investigation into that crime. Do you agree?
He doesn't quite say that. Other people have said that, and I think it's a misstatement of the law.
I say shouldn't, not that he says you would never.
Let me just parse it out for a second. So Rudy Giuliani has said, and he used to have my job, is one of my predecessors at SDNY, said in a way that I think is not – that it's a little bit disingenuous, and I haven't found the cases, but I'm quite certain that he, like I, oversaw cases where an obstruction charge was brought, an obstruction-related charge was brought, and the underlying crime that was being investigated that was obstructed was not charged. I have no doubt about that. What Barr says in the letter, which I had to read many times to sort of read between the lines, is that while not determinative – the question of whether or not the underlying crime was charged has a bearing on the president's intent. And that, is interesting so far as it goes. So I think he has a slightly better analysis and description of what the law is, but I still think he's putting too much weight on the issue of whether or not the underlying crime is charged.
Well, do you think Robert Mueller should have subpoenaed the president?
I go back and forth on that, and I don't know why he didn't press further because I don't have a line into Bob Mueller or his team. But it may have been that he got some information, he got written questions, and he wanted to get the job done on a fairly expeditious basis for lots of reasons. There was a lot of clamor to bring this to a close. Didn't think he was going to get very far in litigation and in trying to compel the president to come and speak. And once you go down that road of trying to compel the president to speak, then you kind of have to see it out. And that literally could have taken months, years, go to the Supreme Court, during which time we'd all be sort of hanging, and he wouldn't have been able to put out his report. I don't know if that's the reason, but I don't think that's a completely illegitimate reason. He was functioning not in a vacuum, but in a highly charged political environment, although I think he himself is not political. And so I don't second guess his decision on that score.
We're talking with Preet Bharara, former U.S. Attorney of the Southern District of New York. He's written a book called Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. We're talking about the Mueller report, the Barr letter on the report. And are you confident, Preet Bharara, that we will get a satisfying, appropriate, I know these are subjective terms, version of the Mueller report that the public will be able to look at?
I'm not absolutely confident. I mean, I really hope so. And I think everyone is served by it. And you had a vote of 420-0 in the House before we knew about the completion of the Mueller report that suggested everybody wants to see it. And people are giving lip service to it. And Bill Barr is using the rhetoric of transparency. But, you know, I worry a little bit that we're not going to see everything. Now, there are legitimate concerns. I'm a former prosecutor, right, about grand jury material, although you can get court orders to open those up, and classified information, and I get that. But I worry a little bit that those are being used as shields to not turn over the entire document. And it's not clear to me how much politics is being played and how much true transparency is being welcomed. What I do think is that to the extent possible, the obstruction part of the Mueller report should be a priority. And, you know, to my mind, you don't have to make the whole thing public all at once if it's 500 pages. But the most important thing is the obstruction-based material because of what we've been talking about, that Bob Mueller did not make a final determination about whether or not a crime was committed. So that's material that Congress needs to see and the public needs to see. And I also think that to the extent there are legitimate concerns about grand jury material and classified material, that that kind of stuff, that kind of information is less likely to be in the obstruction portion of the report, I think, because I think a lot of that investigation was done through voluntary interviews and public statements and other documents obtained, you know, without grand jury subpoena. And so we should be rushing to disclose that.
Well, it sounds like at least a Justice Department official told NPR that a report or some kind of lengthier version of what Barr's summary of the report is would be coming out in weeks, not months. But it sounds like you're suggesting we could potentially get this in parts, like we could get maybe the part about no conspiracy, no collusion first, yeah, and we could really wait on the obstruction portion of it, which is the more questionable part of it. And that's problematic because?
Because I think we need to have the obstruction portion first, if I understood your question correctly.
Well, let me just ask you as a quick follow-up, how unusual is it for an attorney general to release an initial letter from a special counsel's report with, you know, principal findings?
Well,
I don't think we have a lot of
precedents for there being a special counsel of this nature and who had this scope and who provides a particular kind of report. You know, we used to have an independent counsel and that statute lapsed and we don't have that anymore. Although I think we need to get things as soon as possible and we shouldn't be held up on one part so that the other part can be, redacted in the appropriate way. I think the likelihood of that happening is very low, a little bit for political reasons and for optics reasons, because obviously the administration does not have an interest in putting forward the parts of the report in full form that are most damaging to the president. You would think they would be more interested in putting forward the part of the report that is most exculpatory of the president, like it seems to be the collusion part of the report. So, you know, I'm saying that we could do it this way, and I would like to see it done this way. I don't hold out a lot of hope that it will happen that way.
Do you think it's already too late to really have a meaningful conversation on the obstruction question because of the way it's being spun now in terms of total exoneration? That's by the White House. Those are the White House's words and the press secretary's words and the president's words, of course. And then you have similar, though more careful, words from the attorney general.
Well, to me, the words that are most important are the words of Bob Mueller, quoted in part by Bill Barr, who said specifically, this does not exonerate the president. And it's kind of stunning in a way because it looks like it was anticipating the, you know, the quick rhetoric that you expect to hear from the president whenever there's any document of any sort in any court proceeding, whatever it's about, even if it was not about collusion at all, the president will say, no collusion, and I'm exonerated from this. And the special counsel took great pains to say, this is not that. So, you know, as we've been discussing, the attorney general swept in, made a determination in, you know, in a really small period of time. And I'm not sure why we should be stuck with that and go by that. You know, the special counsel decided not to go forward. It's not clear to me at all, and the language of the letter is kind of clever, that the special counsel intended to leave the question to the attorney general. In fact, the attorney general makes clear that simply the fact that the special counsel did not make the decision, he said, leaves it to me. He didn't say the special counsel left it to me or wanted me to do it. He said the fact that the special counsel didn't make a decision leaves it to me. So he basically said, there's a void. He raised his hand. I'm here. I'm going to go into the void. But I think this is a matter for Congress.
You criticized former FBI Director Jim Comey for giving a lengthy explanation of why he did not charge Hillary Clinton for using a private email server, as opposed to just releasing the decision and essentially keeping his mouth shut. But in this case, in terms of the Mueller documents, you are very much supporting the clamor for an explanation. Why is this different?
Yeah, this is the president, and this is a special counsel investigation that has deep public interest. And I would have a different view if it was an ordinary citizen. I'm not saying that Hillary Clinton was an ordinary citizen, but someone who's the president who has the shield, only him. He has the shield of a document that provides an opinion in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department that says a sitting president cannot be prosecuted or indicted. No other human on the earth in this country, or I guess in this country, has such a shield. And as I said before, if you have a close question and you can't resolve it, then I think you go away. I think you don't bring the case. Here you don't have that. And here, because the president is uniquely immunized from prosecution, if you follow that policy, he stands in a different position. And also because he can be held accountable by the Congress. And so I'm sympathetic to the idea that you need to be careful in releasing the report with respect to information that's derogatory about lots of other folks who were looked at and were not prosecuted. I draw the distinction at the president himself.
We're talking with Preet Bharara, former U.S. Attorney of the Southern District of New York. He's written a new book about his experiences there and about the health of our justice system in the Trump era, which we'll get to in the second half of the show. It's called Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. What are your questions for Preet Bharara? The number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. On Facebook, you can tweet us at KQED Forum, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Preet Bharara, who led the Southern District of New York from 2009 till 2017, often called the Sovereign District of New York. We've been talking to him about the Mueller report, the Barr letter on the report, and also his book titled Doing Justice. And if you would like to join the conversation with your questions or thoughts for Preet Bharara, the number 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. The email address, forum@kqed.org. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and our website, kqed.org/forum. Ron asks, and David asks, these are two kind of straight-up legal questions. Can congressmen with sufficient security clearance see the full, unredacted Mueller report? And could news organizations, this is David's question, or Democrats seek an order from the district court judge who oversaw the grand jury to have permission to release the report with the grand jury testimony included? Essentially, who can get to see this full, unredacted version?
Yeah. So nobody until the people who are in possession of it, which is now the Attorney General, the Justice Department, decide that someone should see it. There's always recourse to legal process like you have in anything else, you know, whether it's a U.S. Attorney's Office or a Department of Defense, you know, subsection. People make Freedom of Information Act requests. People make applications to the court. I would think that in the immediate term, that the better way for us to get these to get this information is for there to be, you know, a back and forth, and political pressure, I think, will provide the most compelling force, because protracted litigation will take a long time. And just because a congressman right now has a certain level of security clearance, there's no automatic way in or mechanism for them to receive it. The regulations that apply to the report, you know, are pretty clear that they leave a lot of discretion up to the attorney general. The only thing that was required essentially was that, and what we've seen happen, was that the special counsel provide a confidential report to the attorney general setting forth various things relating to the decisions about prosecuting and declining. And then the only thing that the attorney general was, I believe, required as a matter of regulation and law to provide to the Congress was an explanation of instances where the special counsel sought to do something but was overruled by the attorney general or someone else in the Justice Department. And we've already been told that that never happened.
Yes.
And the rest is sort of left up to discretion. But, you know, I agree with the sentiment of the folks who called in that we really need to see the information.
Well, William asks, does Mueller's report now make the presidency more powerful? And I guess we should say Barr's letter, honestly, because we don't know what the Mueller report is. But he goes on to ask, shouldn't we expect future presidents to use everything in their power to thwart and discredit investigations, to fire persons in the judiciary they consider not loyal to them, and to threaten to prosecute those that attempt to investigate their wrongdoing? And I think this is a really interesting question. Peter Baker at the New York Times wrote that Mr. Mueller's decision not to take a position on whether Mr. Trump's many norm-shattering interventions in the law enforcement system constituted obstruction of justice means that future occupants of the White House will feel entitled to make similar actions.
Yeah, it's something to worry about. I think in a whole host of areas, Donald Trump's decisions to bust norms and to blur the line between politics and law enforcement and to attack, you know, not just in this area, and to attack members of the press by name by using the slogan fake news and now attacking all of mainstream media, not even making the distinction between those he thinks are reporting things incorrectly about him.
Yes.
The attacks on judges, in particular by name, all of those things, I think, set bad precedents for the future. With respect to the law enforcement aspect of this, you know, one hopes that the political process is such that the public decides it doesn't want to have people who are so norm-busting and who are so, easily able to attack fundamental institutions in the country. One of the reasons I wrote the book was to sort of, you know, recenter us on some of the issues that are important to these things.
Yes, and this gets at that question of, well, how would you diagnose the health of our justice system now?
You know, it depends on what time of day it is for me, if I'm going to be very honest. I'm still optimistic because I think that there's lots and lots of good people. I mean, a central theme of the book Doing Justice is that good laws are not enough. Right? That's what animated me to write this book and how I led the office. You know, to the extent people are concerned about the justice system and about how it's, you know, things are playing out, I would note for them the laws really haven't changed. The Constitution is the same. Title 18, which has most of the criminal laws, is the same. Most of the regulations are the same. One thing that has changed, by the way, in favor of, I think, justice has been criminal justice reform. So that's gotten even a little bit better. What has changed is the nature of the people who are interpreting the laws and who are enforcing them and how they see them and how they talk about them and what respect they give to them and what, you know, amount of public faith they cause other people to have in them. And that, I think, has gone down the tubes a bit. So, you know, you got to make sure that as you're interpreting the law and enforcing the law, that you have good folks. I quote at the beginning of the book Clarence Darrow, the most famous criminal defense lawyer of all time, who in defending someone in a capital case, he made clear, an African-American man who was trying to defend his brother's home and shot someone and killed him, and he was on trial for his life. And Clarence Darrow uttered these words that have always stayed with me and that sort of ring throughout my time as U.S. attorney and throughout the book. He says, you know, no matter what laws we pass, no matter what precautions we take, unless the people we meet are kindly and decent and human and liberty-loving, then there is no liberty. Freedom, he goes on to say, comes from human beings rather than from laws and institutions. And so I have a lot of faith and a lot of good people who I think will come forward and enter public service and vote the right way. But I do have a lot of deep concerns.
Yes, and the reaction by the president since the Barr letter came out, has said hopefully someone's going to look at the other side, that this was an illegal takedown that failed. He's thrown out the word treason. I mean, first, can you just define treason?
You know, treason refers to something that is an act that you engage in with respect to a party against whom we have declared war. And treason is thrown around by a lot of people in different contexts.
He's trying to suggest that it is equal to criticizing the president.
Yeah, well, that's what he says about fake news. That's, you know, anyone who says something that he doesn't like, he accuses of some kind of subversion. The odd thing about that is, you know, the Russia investigation was already sort of underway when Bob Mueller was appointed. But all of this nonsense that the president called, all the stuff that the president calls nonsense and a witch hunt, was set in motion by his own deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, who is his appointee, who is a Republican. And this whole business about obstruction and why that was begun to be looked at was because Rod Rosenstein appointed an independent counsel in the wake of Jim Comey being fired, which was viewed by a lot of people as an obstructive act, especially since the president went on television and told Lester Holt of NBC that I had in my mind the Russia investigation when I fired Jim Comey. So he brought all of this upon himself. It's not some coup. It's actually an undertaking that was done by almost exclusively Republicans at the top, whom he appointed. He appointed Rod Rosenstein. He appointed Chris Wray. They were following the law. And the fact that an investigation doesn't ultimately determine that there is a prosecution is something to be credited if it was done properly. And so if it was the case, you know, I think it's a measure of honor when people don't prejudge an investigation. You start an investigation where there's smoke, as I say in the book repeatedly. At the end of the day, sometimes you bring a charge, sometimes you don't. If it was the case that every time you started an investigation, it had to end with a prosecution, otherwise it was deemed a coup or deemed improper, then we would be living in a hellscape.
Well, let's go to our listeners and see what questions they have for you on that note. Anne in Campbell. Join us.
Hi, Preet-Bharara. You are my hero. I just ordered a T-shirt that says such about a week ago, and I'm going to wear that at the gym. I'm definitely not a T-shirt-wearing person, but I'm going to wear that one, and I thank you for all you do. I do have a question. Basically, what can we as individuals do in the next year to improve the situation in the Trump Gate. I just read an article, I think, by Applegate in Washington Post about what laws we could change to make sure that the presidency is shored up against this again in the future. And also, have you seen the documentary Hot Coffee, and what do you think about that?
Well, thanks for the kind words and for wearing such a T-shirt. I don't even have a T-shirt like that. I'm not sure I was aware there was such a T-shirt, so wear it in good health.
Thank you.
And then your last question, I have not seen that production, so I don't have a comment on it. Look, what can people do? I think people can educate themselves. People can be active and engage in activism. You know, some bad things that have happened that we sort of forgotten about because they're out of the news have been rectified in part because ordinary citizens like you and others have decided to make a big deal about them. Remember, we had the separations at the border. Now, there's still a problem there. There's still a lot of families separated. But there was an about-face of policy and almost as close as you're going to get to a mea culpa on the part of the president and the administration, because lots and lots of people said this is outrageous and, you know, America is better than this. Also, lots of people, you know, came to the defense of folks who were not being let into the country because the president at least initially sought a complete and total Muslim ban, as he talked about during the campaign. And you know, even if you're not a lawyer, there are ways to support that kind of conduct and that kind of activity and that kind of public service. So there's lots of ways that ordinary people can deal with the situation. And what I always say, even though I had a powerful position, Bob Mueller is in a powerful position, coming to an end or maybe has come to an end, that prosecutions and the criminal law are not going to solve every important problem. And if you think the country is going in the wrong direction and you think we're, you know, heading towards a situation where the rule of law is not respected, you know, a prosecution here or there, even if it's a significant one, is not going to undo the damage and is not going to set us on the right course. It can do some mitigation, and holding people accountable will give other people faith in the rule of law. But it will really take is people who use their voice and their votes to change the direction of the country.
And thanks for the question. Let me go next to Wynn in Menlo Park. Hi, Wynn.
Hi, thank you very much. Now that the report, the Mueller report, is complete, is it possible that the Attorney General Barr or the President could simply dismantle all the cases that were spawned by the Mueller investigation and are now outstanding in the Southern District of New York and other federal districts?
Wynn, thanks. And if you wouldn't mind, Pipara, what other things do you think are out there based on, you know, the hints that we got from their prosecution of Michael Cohen at the Southern District of New York?
Yeah, so one thing we know is out there is continued cooperation or attempted cooperation by Michael Cohen, who's already been sentenced and who's essentially said in open court and adopted by the Southern District and adopted by the judge in that case that he committed that campaign finance violation that he accepted responsibility for and for which he is going to prison for a period of time. He said he did that in coordination with and at the direction of Individual One, lots of people's favorite nickname for the president now. There are also reports that the Southern District is looking at the inaugural committee and other aspects of business by the Trump Organization. But one thing I want to make clear, and this will become very clear if you read the book, is that the men and women of the Southern District of New York are aggressive, fair, apolitical, and fearless. And in fact, I dedicate the book to my family and to the what I call the fearless women and men of the Southern District of New York, the best place I will ever work. And they'll follow the law and the facts wherever they take them. They're not going to go rogue, but they will be strong and independent. And if they see wrongdoing, they'll announce it.
What do you mean by they're not going to go rogue?
Well, there's been this discussion of whether or not people in the Southern District of New York would decide to indict a sitting president openly, given that there's a policy of the Justice Department. And I don't think that they will. So they're not going to sort of defy, I think, longstanding, even if you disagree with them, longstanding principles and practices of the Justice Department. But they are not going to be stymied. And so to the spirit of your question, can Donald Trump shut things down? I suppose he could try, but it's a really, really difficult thing when you now have diffuse responsibility for lots of prosecutions and you have, you know, line-level career people who are delving into matters. To have someone reach down into an office and say, knock it off, is very difficult. You know, Jeff Berman, my successor, who's the U.S. attorney in the Southern District now, has, as I understand it, recused himself from the Michael Cohen case. So you have career people, not even an appointee of the president, who are overseeing these things. You know, one of the reasons why you may remember that I didn't return a phone call from the president because I believed in having an arm's length relationship with people who were in political power.
And 20 hours after that, you were fired.
I was asked to resign, and then I was fired the next day.
Well, you were asked to resign.
So the spirit of those people is very strong. And I think that if anyone tried to shut down a case because it was going to be favorable to the president, that all hell would break loose.
And certainly for people who want to know what it's like to work at the Southern District of New York, your book does do a very good job of laying out what that is like. And clearly you have a lot of faith and affection for the office.
I do.
And again, the book is Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. And we're talking with Preet Bharara. Mark asks, why were there no cases filed in the financial crash of 2008? Would he have done anything different in hindsight? Pipar, you write a lot about restraint and the significance of restraint at the Southern District of New York. And I know you get asked about this a lot, but do you think you exercise too much restraint in not going after Wall Street and the top executives at the big banks in the wake of the financial crisis, who clearly acted with recklessness and greed?
Recklessness and greed is not necessarily a crime.
No, I know.
And
that's not the only thing that they did.
I don't think that I acted with restraint. There are literally thousands of people, hundreds and thousands of people, who looked at every aspect of the financial crisis and conduct that was undertaken, some of which was greedy, some of which may have been criminal, a lot of which was reckless, a lot of which was negligent on the part of lots of folks. And as I write in a chapter that's, you know, very resonant today, as we think about the Mueller report and the financial crisis, you know, walking away can be very difficult. But you can only do what the law allows and what the facts compel. And remember that before I and the other people who were looking at these things all over the country, by the way, not just in the Southern District, but in the Eastern District of New York, in Washington, D.C., in New Jersey, in Northern California, in Southern California, in Chicago, regulatory agencies also. Literally hundreds of people who all had a motivation, a personal motivation too, because they suffered in the financial crisis also, as well as a duty as part of their jobs to hold people accountable if they could be. all militated in the same direction, which is if there was a case to be brought at the highest level, they would bring it. You know, I would point out also that regulatory agencies that have a much lower burden of proof, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but just a preponderance of the evidence, with another, you know, hundreds and thousands of people who are looking at all these things, they never saw their way, I think not out of fear and not out of intimidation and not out of lack of expertise, but because of a lack of direct facts, they never brought even a civil enforcement action in, you know, against a head of a financial institution in connection with a financial crisis, which is a not a satisfactory answer for a lot of people. It wasn't satisfactory to folks in my office. But on the issue of whether or not there was restraint, it wasn't the case that people said, well, here's a case to bring of securities fraud or of mail fraud or of wire fraud. Is it a tough case or not? Those cases weren't there in some measure because people acted in a way to immunize themselves and give themselves plausible deniability. But you have to have some direct proof of an individual directing bad behavior. And lots of people got away with lots of terrible things, but that's the system we have. And I hope if you take the time to read the chapter in the whole book, you'll understand that as frustrating as it may be, some cases are not able to be brought.
Well, one of the criticisms that I was fascinated by in your book was that every time you brought a case against an Indian American or a South Asian person, you'd be accused of being a self-hater.
Yeah, so it's fascinating, right? So when you investigate people, they don't like it. And people will come up with all sorts of reasons and excuses and try to blame other people. And so, sometimes people will say, well, you're anti-Democrat, you're anti-Republican. I've been banned by Russia, by Vladimir Putin, for a particular case we brought against an arms dealer named Victor Boot.
Yes.
The president of Turkey tried to get me fired during the Obama administration, President Erdogan. You know, I'm anti-Turk. We have been called anti-Chinese because of, you know, certain gang cases we brought. But then sometimes people have to twist themselves even further to suggest that even if they were defendants who were of my same ethnic origin, Indian American, well, you must hate them too because you're self-hating. So I found that very peculiar. And it's an interesting thing where people decide to sort of accuse the accusers so they can deflect responsibility from themselves. And obviously it's ludicrous.
Not just peculiar, but it felt like, at least for me in reading your book, it was one moment where it seemed like it was troubling. Like,
well, you know, it happens to be the case that, you know, there's all sorts of people who get prosecuted. And there happen to be Indian Americans in the hedge fund industry. You know, there's a gentleman out now, and I wasn't going to address it, but he's got a book, Rajat Gupta, who was prosecuted by my office, who has apparently suggested in his book, which you should not buy, I don't know if we can do an anti-plug, has suggested that, again, I was, you know, critical of Indian Americans, and I was trying to show my whiteness or something by prosecuting Indian Americans, and I had a chip on my shoulder. And people like him forget, you know, I don't go out in the world and say, bring me the head of an Indian. There are career prosecutors who do these things. And in fact, the prosecution of the number of those folks at hedge funds who were of South Asian descent, those investigations began before I took office. The wiretaps in those cases began before I took office. Rajat Gupta was a target of an investigation by the Southern District of New York by my predecessors. I arrived on the scene. Those cases and the investigation were largely done. And prosecutors who are not Indian American and not self-hating in any regard made recommendations to prosecute those people, and then they were. So I'm a little bit, I got to say, and I'm usually an even-tempered guy, disgusted by those accusations because they're silly and they don't do those people any good, and it's a little bit pathetic.
And it hurt your family. It hurt your parents.
My parents are very proud of the work I've done. And when we prosecuted a diplomat who was an Indian diplomat who victimized another Indian, but for some reason people took the side of the diplomat. It wasn't the case of the century. I actually knew nothing about it until it was brought. I'm not, you know, personally involved in every case, but the buck stops at my desk. And there are people in India who thought that, again, this was something that I ordered and orchestrated to prove, you know, something about myself, to prove myself white. I think it's an interesting thing that people don't understand how great a country America is. This is my sort of more philosophical analysis of that. And, you know, folks in India, the country, and I'm very proud of my Indian heritage, and I was born there, and it's a part of my heritage and my life, and I want my, you know, kids to understand their backgrounds and heritage, too. I'm incredibly proud of it. But some folks there find it hard to believe, I think, that an Indian guy named Preet Bharara could ascend to the highest law enforcement position in Manhattan without doing something like shedding his culture or shedding his heritage or being ashamed of being from that part of the world or having to prove himself white in some way, because the reverse couldn't happen in India. I'm not sure, you know, a white American who emigrates to India could become the chief prosecutor of Delhi without doing something similar to that. It's not a criticism of India, but it's praise I'm giving to the United States of America. So, it played out. You realize to short circuit, you get to the punchline when I finally started to feel that I got some perspective on it. As I recite in the book, people in India would call me an Uncle Tom because of these prosecutions that were fairly brought and everyone got a fair trial. And so at one point somebody wrote that, obviously Preet Bharara is doing these things because he's trying to prove himself to his white masters, to which I thought, yes, presumably Eric Holder and Barack Obama. So sometimes you have to separate appropriate criticism from absurd criticism. And pay attention to the first and ignore the second.
And it sounds like inject a little humor as well.
Yes.
Elizabeth in Oakland, join us.
Hi, I have a question, but before that I want to just make a statement that I believe to be true. And that is, the world is filled with complicated things. We have to spend some time and effort to understand complicated issues, and anything that's expressed in as short as a tweet is a manipulation. So this is what I'd like to hear you respond to. In educated circles right now, it's common to hear people make the statement, truth is subjective. And there is, and I understand why they're saying that. But in the terms of the American justice system, based on, tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, that seems to me to be kind of a threat to our whole system of justice, that we shouldn't have a concept of truth as being concrete and verifiable, but rather all start to agree that truth is subjective. I'll take your response to this off the air.
Yes, Elizabeth,
thank you.
You've hit one of the points in
Preet's
book.
Yeah, part of the reason for writing the book is to get back to the central premise that there is such a thing as truth. Was the trigger pulled or not? Were the books cooked or not? Was a lie told or not? Now, some things you can't get to the truth, and that's where subjectivity may come in, because you have, let's say, a crime has taken place, and three people come and testify, and they conflict with each other. Obviously, there is an objective truth: who shot the victim? But there are times where you can't end up bringing a case, because multiple people say different things and you cannot get the truth. That's a very different thing from saying there is no truth, or the truth is subjective. And it's that blurring that I absolutely agree with you is a problem in this country. One of my favorite podcast guests on Stay Tuned with Preet, a podcast I have, was Garry Kasparov, the famous, the greatest chess player of all time, who knows a lot about autocracy and propaganda from his time in the Soviet Union. And he says, the beginning of the slide to anti-democratic government is not that, people dispute the truth, not that you have your leaders say, well, that's a lie. It's when they start to spread this gospel that there is no truth, exactly what we were talking about, that everything is subjective. And when you have people around the president like Kellyanne Conway, who uses terms like alternative facts, and Rudy Giuliani saying things like truth isn't truth, then you're starting to slip down that road. I don't mean to be overly alarmist about it.
No, but do you think we're headed toward an autocracy?
No, because we have...
too many checks and balances, and that
we have checks and balances, and you have limited terms of the presidency. But we have a president with autocratic tendencies and autocratic fantasies. He embraces some of the policies and actions of Duterte in the Philippines, Erdogan in Turkey, Putin in Russia. Meanwhile, attacking our democratic allies in Canada and the UK and elsewhere, that's not right. That's not appropriate. And the president threatens a lot of things, and I wonder. He talks about changing the libel laws. He talks about yanking licenses from the media. He can't do those things because we still have a nation of laws. But my gosh, I wonder if he had the ability to do so, would he? And my sense is that he would do a lot of things, even if they would be bad for America, because they would be good for him.
Well, Tanya asks, can you please ask your guest if he would ever be interested in running for a higher office?
Higher office than podcast host? An author?
Apparently there is one.
I don't know about that. So, you know, I believe in public service. I was in public service for 17 years, and then I was removed from public service, and I continue to care about it, and I engage in activities that hopefully lift people's public understanding of our institutions and the law and the criminal justice system. If there's some opportunity to serve again, I would consider it. There was an opportunity to run for Attorney General of the state of New York that I thought about, but, you know, politics is not my cup of tea. I think there are other ways to serve. I don't like the idea of raising money. I don't like how money has such a huge role in politics. So I'll take it under advisement.
Well, we have 30 seconds left. Leave us with your best piece of advice for how the law can salvage public discourse in 2019.
So as I write it in the book at some length, you know, people make fun of lawyers and they disparage them. But the one thing about lawyers in court that we can, I think, learn from is that rather than what happens in public life now, people silo themselves and they don't listen to other points of view. And they listen to only people who agree with them in court. You have to listen to your adversary. You have to engage with your adversary. And you have to do it in a respectful way, not through fear. And there's something really good and honorable about that, and we should get back to that.
Doing Justice, that's the title of Preet Bharara's book. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on. That was a lot of fun.
I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Another Hour of Forum is next. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.